In the middle of the stresses and the turmoil of the world, simply breathe, return to the breath, and make that your simplest of simple practices.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Helping with Dr. Richard Schuster. Food for the brain, knowledge from the experts, tools to win at life. I'm your host, Dr. Richard. Whoever you are, wherever you're from, and whatever you do, this is the show that is going to help you become the best version of yourself. Each episode, you will hear from some of the most amazing, talented, and successful people on the planet who followed their passions and strive to help others. Join our movement to get a million people each day to commit acts of kindness for others. Together, we're going to make the world a better place. Are you ready? Because it's time for your Daily Helping. Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Daily Helping Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Richard, and I am so excited about our guest today. He's actually making his second appearance on the show. His name is Dawson Church. He came on way back in episode 231. We're going to link to that in the show notes. But Dawson Church is a best-selling science writer and the author of four award-winning books. The Genie in Your Genes broke new ground by showing that gene expression is influenced by emotions. Mind to Matter is based on hundreds of studies showing us that our brains play a key role in constructing the reality around us. And in Brain Bliss, he demonstrated that as we cultivate peak states, our brains rapidly rewire themselves for happiness. He's here today to talk about his newest book, Spiritual Intelligence, which maps the neuroscience of awakened states of consciousness. His mission is to inspire personal transformation through his presentations, podcasts, books, and blog posts. He's been involved in over 100 scientific studies published in peer-reviewed journals, many as principal investigator, and has collaborated with researchers from the most prestigious institutions, including Harvard Medical School, California Pacific Medical Center, Emory, Columbia, and Duke, to name a few. Dawson, welcome back to the Daily Helping. It is amazing to have you with us again.
Hey, if we have as much fun on air as we've just had off air chatting, it's going to be a fabulous episode. So great to be here.
Guaranteed to have as much fun or your money back for sure. Yeah, it's amazing to me how quickly time has flown by. We were talking about our various interests, and this new book that you've written, Spiritual Intelligence, is a topic that's so fascinating to me because I, in recent years, I've kind of dipped the podcasting toe into this world of what if we talked about these more esoteric, these more spiritual topics, but could we ground them in science? Because there's so many people that are out there that are espousing all of these things if you give them a like and subscribe or buy their products, right? But what I love about you is that you are and have always been deeply grounded in science as a fundamental piece of everything you do. So I did mention episode 231. That was the episode where you and I took a deep dive into Brain Bliss. Everybody should go listen to that again. I'll link to it in the show notes. But Spiritual Intelligence, Dawson, why did you write that book and why now?
I wanted to give people an insight into what goes on in your brain when you are in these altered states. And the dialogue between experience and neuroscience is really interesting. So there are these esoteric states that Tibetan monks, Franciscan nuns, people of elevated experiences have been talking about for a long time. They're having these experiences where they lose their sense of personal identity and find themselves merging with something greater than themselves. And so Rumi and St. Francis and Teresa, all of these great mystics explain that they've had these experiences where they were one with the infinite. And it seems like a very, very esoteric kind of experience. Although it turns out that when you look at the research, virtually everybody has had some taste of that in their lives, whether it was on a vacation where they saw a beautiful sunset, or they got lost in a beautiful piece of music, or they were holding somebody, they were holding a baby, they were holding the head of a dying person. In some way, we're all getting access to these elevated states. What neuroscience has begun doing, which I think is so remarkable, is putting these people into MRIs and seeing what's going on in their brains, looking at EEGs of what is going on when they're in these elevated states. And we're seeing patterns that they aren't random, they're very consistent, and they're consistent across religions, whether this is a Christian mystic, whether it's a Buddhist or a Hindu or a Jain or a Sufi, their brain patterns look the same. So I wrote Spiritual Intelligence to both share what the experience is like. What's it like to lose yourself in the infinite, to have that experience that is what Abraham Maslow called the self-transcendent state, or Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi in Flow talked about these states where you're simply one with the all it is. So there are those states and those experiences. But what's so interesting is what's going on in your brain. And it turns out there are distinct brain signatures of what its activity looks like. So my new book, Spiritual Intelligence, covers those, what those brain states look like, and how we all have the hardware in our brains to experience those states. We've just got to turn it on.
You said a couple things that piqued my antenna, so to speak, because initially you mentioned altered states of consciousness, and then you, a few moments later, talked about elevated states of consciousness. So, for operationalization standpoint, or rather for giving us definitions, let's call it that, do you see those things as the same or a different side of the same coin? What do we think when we talk about elevated versus altered states of consciousness?
Yeah, lots of altered states, and a very simple one we all have every day is sleep. When we sleep, I remember having a dream where I was in the San Francisco airport, but I was frying eggs in the airport lounge, and I was frying them for Tony Robbins. Now, that's a really bizarre dream, and we all have these totally bizarre dreams every night. So we're in these highly altered states that look like drug trips every night, where our prefrontal cortex is shut down, and the back of our brain, the visual association cortex, is all lit up, and we're having these altered states. That's one kind of altered state. One category of altered states is a transcendent state. And when Abraham Maslow was building his hierarchy of needs, initially he put as the capstone of that, as that people self-actualize, they live their full potential. But toward the end of his life, Maslow realized that there was a higher peak to his pyramid that went beyond self-actualization, and that's self-transcendence. And so that's when you lose your sense of identity as an individual human being. You feel part of something greater than yourself. So that's the experience in nature, sitting looking at the Grand Canyon or staring at a mountain or feeling the sand between your toes on the beach and just feeling one with all that is. And we all have these kinds of experiences of being more than just our small local individual self. So that's an experience that's far more than just an altered state. It's also a self-transcendent state, getting out of our little worried human, what Jean Houston calls the dreary skin bag of the human ego, and moving into these, what the Buddhists call being one with everything. We all have access to those states. And it turns out that these great spiritual masters and mystics who cultivate the experience of those states learn how to turn them on. How quickly? Andrew Newberg, who's done a lot of research on this, finds that initially it takes the average person a while to get into those states, even if they meditate regularly. But these monks and nuns, when they are in an MRI and the researchers say, feel compassion, they see spikes of certain brain waves and activation of certain brain regions in about 30 seconds. So people with practice can learn to move into these elevated states really, really quickly. And then the other thing that's remarkable is they change the brain. In one of the case histories in Spiritual Intelligence, it's a TV host in Australia with a show called Catalyst. And he'd heard about meditation, didn't put much stock in it, but heard about its health effects and thought, I'll go ahead and I'll learn meditation. So he took his TV crew into an advanced neuroimaging lab and spent a day getting brain scans, cognitive tests. They mapped every single part of his brain down to the last neuron using very, very high resolution MRIs. And that was the before picture. He then began a daily meditation practice and learned mindfulness. And within a couple of weeks, his behavior was changing. After 2 months, he went back in the lab and they measured his brain again. And the emotion regulation core of his brain in 8 weeks had grown by 22.8%. Now think about that. 22.8% growth in a emotion regulation part of the brain in just 2 months. So it turns out that as we're having these states of transcendence, our brains are responding, they're growing, they're changing, and the brains of people who are doing this regularly look very different from those who aren't. They're much calmer, they're far more resilient to life's problems, their immunity spikes, their creativity increases. The creativity can go up by more than double. So research is now showing that there are these massive shifts in the actual hardware of our brains, as well as the software of our minds, when we're having these transcendent experiences.
What does spiritual intelligence speak to with respect to the types of altered states of consciousness, right? You mentioned Franciscan monks or Buddhists, or, you know, or you said nuns, but is there, when you look at, you know, hook them up to an MRI, are the same parts of your brains lighting up if you're, you know, really advanced, like a Tibetan monk versus somebody that uses MDMA or something of the like? Like, are we seeing that there's different kinds of altered states that create different sorts of regional activity within the brain experientially?
There are, but there are commonalities. And so what we're looking for, as well as the differences, is what's a commonality? And so there are two big commonalities. One is that the mid-prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain right behind your forehead over here, it's what makes you you. It constructs your sense of personality. So you know your name is Richard Schuster. I know my name is Dawson Church. I made sure before I began talking to you today, I went and put on a nice shirt, so it looked decent. I had a high-definition microphone. You know, this is all me thinking about the Dawson Church and having this image of what I do and who I am. That's all built by the mid-prefrontal cortex. And so what we see in these monks and nuns is that part of the brain gets very quiet. It's not very active. We also see in other research, for example, with people with major depressive disorder, it is highly active. And these parts of the brain that are highly active get bigger. Neurons that fire together wire together. So these parts of the brain start to grow. So that's one key, really key region, is the mid-prefrontal cortex. Has a lot of other functions, but a core one is building one's personality. And it's just dramatic whether these people are Christians or Buddhists or Jews or Shintoists. They all have the same pattern, that part of the brain, I, me, mine. And the trouble with personality and that sense of self is it's always worried about the stuff that hurt me in the past, what might go wrong in the future. So it's not a very happy part of the brain. It's a core part of what makes us suffer. To be is to suffer. To have that sense of self is to have this fragile ego that is subject to the slings and arrows, our fortune. So in these monks and nuns, that part gets quiet. The other commonality, whether it's, again, at the end, if you look at all a lot of the drug research, the ketone research, and the research into MDMA, psilocybin, a commonality is it tends to quiet that mid-prefrontal cortex. So this person who's been really obsessed with their history and their PTSD and their problems of their future and all of the threats to their existence, the drug just mechanically dials that down, but the meditator does it without drugs. It dials down naturally, and they get freedom from that obsessive worry about me and mine and what will happen to me. So that's the first key, is that this commonality is that part of the brain, the mid-prefrontal cortex, gets quiet. And the other commonality, especially in certain kinds of meditation, is that a lobe, a big lobe of the brain called the insula, gets active. And the reason you want an active insula is that it is the seat of compassion. When we're feeling compassion, love for everybody, when we're letting go of our individual worries, we're feeling that sense of oneness with everything, self-transcendence, we feel immense compassion. And the insula in our MRI research, the insula lights up like a Christmas tree when we're having these experiences. And not only is it compassion, the insula plays a role in other positive emotions like gratitude and awe and altruism and optimism, happiness. All of these things involve the insula. That part of the brain gets active. So there are differences depending on the kind of meditation, the kind of practice used, but those are the two commonalities: a deactivation of the mid-prefrontal cortex, which is the suffering self and an activation of all of these pro-social emotions and the insula of the brain.
We talked about the TV guy that saw these big changes in a short amount of time. I wonder what the research shows about the amygdala. A lot of the fear and the worry and the anxiety and the anger, and you know, there's an amygdalic loop that people, they're caught up in, and they've basically, what you said is a true statement. What wires together fires together. People have created neuronal structures in their brains based on things they take in from their environment, stimuli, which trigger them, and they get into these wild states of fear and, in many cases, anger. What are our MRIs showing that this type of work does to that region of the brain?
In a nutshell, and I cover this in Chapter 2 of Spiritual Intelligence, in a nutshell, in people who are hypervigilant, who have PTSD, who have a lot of anxiety and depression, the amygdala grows. It's a threat center. It's sending that signal of threat down into the body for fight or flight. And so if you're activating that all the time, you're firing it often and it wires, it gets larger. So the amygdala grows in people with all of those diagnoses. The amygdala shrinks in these monks and nuns. One of the cool things I looked at was if there's an end point to happiness. Like I wondered, are there places these monks and nuns go to eventually, and we can maybe go to as well, where you are just so happy? Because we see their happiness levels going up dramatically when we measure, especially the brainwave gamma. It's a wave of integration, compassion, and happiness. So we see their brainwaves increase, gamma brainwaves increasing. And I wondered if there's a plateau. So in one study looking at monks who meditated a lot compared to monks who've meditated a crazy amount, like 50,000 hours in their lives, that was one of the key differences. The amygdala activation had dropped by about 75% in those monks, and the amygdala is shrinking. The other part of the brain that shrinks in these monks and nuns is the nucleus accumbens, and that is the reward center, very active in addicts. If you look at fentanyl, look at cocaine, heroin, even chocolate, it triggers that dopamine response. People want this crave thing, and that's the nucleus accumbens. That starts to shrink as well in these people. So the amygdala shrinks. Also, the other interesting group of people in whom the amygdala shrinks is Alzheimer's patients who meditate. And so, of course, I don't know if you're aware how this much this is on your radar yet, but in Chapter 2 of the book, I cover the study showing that there's natural brain shrinkage as we age, but there's also accelerated shrinkage in Alzheimer's, and it goes along with cognitive decline. And the Alzheimer's brain can shrink up to 70%. And that's a lot of brain shrinkage. I mean, I've got an image in Chapter 2 of an Alzheimer's brain postmortem and a regular normal brain matched for age and gender. And the Alzheimer's brain has shrunk 70%.
That's wild.
Tiny little brain. In research with Alzheimer's patients using MRIs who are meditating, we find that that starts to reverse itself, that literally the brains of these Alzheimer's patients begin to grow when they meditate, except for the amygdala. The amygdala gets smaller because they're no longer so stressed. So it's one of the most amazing things is that we now know we can treat Alzheimer's by simply having people meditate. Now, this isn't just any old meditation. I mean, these are highly targeted, evidence-based methods that they're using. They're having to be consistent half an hour a day for at least 6 months before we can detect brain growth. But we're detecting brain growth and a reversal of that shrinkage. And I cover all this research into Chapter 2. It's amazing. We now literally can take people with cognitive decline and Alzheimer's and reverse those things in terms of brain function.
Hey guys, Dr. Richard here. For the past 7 years, I've been privileged to bring you incredible guests who are changing the world and can help you become the best version of yourself. I'm really excited to share with you a new quiz that I created based on my clinical training that will curate for you a custom list of my top episodes and actionable strategies to help you wherever you are on your journey. All you need to do is go to drrichardschuster.com to take it, and it's 100% free. You'll be taking the next step on the journey to unlocking the power of you, and I can't wait to see where you'll go. right. So somebody's listening to this, they're nodding along. They're probably like, you know what, Dawson, I'm sold, but I'm not a monk. I don't have 50,000 hours of meditation under my belt. I'm busy. I've got kids. I don't have time. Talk to us about how we deploy this in our lives in a way that we can gain benefit from it, measure it, but do so to where we don't have to be sitting in a Buddhist temple for 10 hours a day.
Yeah, that is the crux of things. We can't afford to do that. And so I developed about 20 years ago, I developed a form of meditation called eco meditation, which is just a really simple evidence-based form of seven simple things you do to generate heart coherence, to relax certain muscles, to drive you into parasympathetic nervous system function. And so you just do these simple things and physiologically you drop into a meditative state. So I designed this thing. I've had it around for many, many years now. But in an MRI study of eco meditation, we took people off the street who weren't meditators and we put them in an MRI and we measured brain volume, brain function, and we matched them with a control group who just did mindful breathing for the same amount of time and then gave them a meditation track, told them, do this for a month, come back into the lab, we'll measure your MRI brain volume and functionality again. We did that. And when they came back, and again, these are ordinary people just scraped off the street, volunteering for a research study at a university, and they come back after 1 month of using eco meditation, and we put them back in the machines, and their mid prefrontal cortex is quietened down, and their insula is all lit up. So their brain function looks like 10,000-hour meditators. And all they've done is meditate 20 minutes a day for a month. So that's the beauty of science. We're now reverse engineering what these Tibetan monks, Franciscan nuns, these master meditators are doing, and we're making it accessible for free to everyone. And this is our passion. This is what science is giving us. We didn't have this, 5,000, 10,000 years ago. We now have it in the form of empirical studies to know what really works and what can get the average person into these elevated states really quickly and again start to change their brains.
Okay, I have to ask because it just makes sense to me. I know that there have been studies that environmental things can influence meditative states, that there are temples and there are cathedrals that are 1200 plus years old that are designed in such a way to amplify harmonic resonance. And they've studied that and they know that that can help enhance what you're talking about.
Yeah, I like those things because they are priming cues. It's going to prime you to walk into a place like Lancaster Cathedral and feel all the prayer that's been offered up over there for 1,000 years. So yeah, priming will do it. Your mandala will do it. Your prayer beads will do it. There are all kinds of ways you can trigger these experiences. But as long as you're depending on external triggers, whether it's a drug or whether it's a religion, have to learn to generate these states yourself. I talked to an old Cherokee medicine woman when I was writing a previous book and said, you're a plant medicine woman. Tell me about this. And she said, my plant medicine can tell people, can show them there's a there, but then they have to go away and figure out how to get themselves there without these external stimuli. So the external ways, that ketamine journey is going to tell you there's a there. What do you do afterwards? That's where you have to go and figure out how to do it yourself. And that's where you need a way of generating these states endogenously, which these Tibetans and Franciscans and others have been learning to do and perfecting, honing now for hundreds of years, thousands of years. And those methods, if you call the evidence-based forms of them, are really effective in doing that without drugs, without the cathedral. Some of these people are in prison and they're meditating and they're reaching elevated states. There's a whole literature on prison enlightenment, for example, people in adverse circumstances. In fact, there's a whole link between adversity and breaking through to elevated states. Two-thirds of people, when they go through a traumatic event, actually experience post-traumatic growth. So it's not being comfortable that makes us grow. Often it's the worst things in our lives that stimulate us to break through to those transcendent states.
It makes perfect sense. And a lot of times we trap ourselves in these loops because whatever that bad event was will kind of paralyze us from dealing with it. And, but mentally we're there, right? We're re-experiencing it. I mean, that's PTSD, right? You're just reliving over and over again. But we're talking about ways to break through. So as I'm talking and I'm loving our conversation, Dawson, as you know, most individuals listening to the show are not going to have an MRI in their home. And you did mention that, for example, the guy in Australia, the TV guy, he was able to get back into a neuroscience lab and do very high resolution imaging of his brain. There are qualitative changes, of course, that we may observe that our family members may say, hey, you're 12% less of a jerk today, Dawson, right? But are there quantitative ways that we as individuals who, again, are not running to an MRI can measure these changes in us as we go through this process?
What a fabulous question, Richard. And yeah, one of the cool findings, and we in research, of course, we're using the MRIs or the EEGs or other ways of looking at what's going on inside the body and the brain, but we're also giving people questionnaires. How do you feel? And they're very, very simple questionnaires. The one I use for happiness in my studies is a simple questionnaire. And this guy, I thought this was a joke when I first read his study. His name is Dr. Abdul Khalik. He lives in England. And he looked at these que happiness questionnaires. They're very, very detailed ones developed by positive psychology researchers. And some of them are 300 items long. They take, an hour to complete. And so he validated his happiness questionnaire against all of these ones that take a long time to do. And his questionnaire is one item long, and it's how happy do you feel? 0 through 10. I thought it was a joke when I first read it, but it's validated against all of these long instruments. So just how happy you feel, rate your joy as 0 through 10. Now, the useful one is rate your emotional pain 0 through 10, rate your physical pain 0 through 10. And it turns out when we correlate these with these exotic instruments, or we correlate them with empirical changes, like, for example, your gene expression, your hormones, like cortisol. How much cortisol do you have? How much cortisol are you sending a signal to your adrenal medulla to create in your body? And when we measure those kinds of empirical objective measures against the subjective question, like how happy are you, they correlate. So you feeling good, you simply having that sense of well-being internally in your heart, in your body, correlates with all of the science. And so that's all we have you focus on is how do I feel? How do I feel right now? How does my body feel when I'm tuning into my breath? How do I feel? How do my emotions feel? Do I have inner peace? And it turns out that that is as good as an MRI for letting us know what's really going on inside your body. Feel good, and all of these positive things are going on internally, even though we can't measure them.
I love this. So as you were talking and I was formulating my next question, I had this image in my mind of a person who goes to the gym and spends an hour working out and then goes home and eats a salad with ranch dressing all over it and cheese and bacon. So where I want your help next for everyone listening is you've given us this roadmap of something we can do that we can empirically measure and improve our lives in so many different ways. What are the things we need to not do, or at least really minimize, that are going to derail the progress with this?
Yeah, and obviously, diet can do that. Clean things, clean food, clean water can do that. Compassion and relationships do that. So, at the end of every chapter of Spiritual Intelligence, I have a section called Deepening Practices, and I have things I recommend people do. So, go to the end of each chapter, read the Deepening Practices. It's not just a book about spiritual intelligence. There are free meditations along with every chapter that help you develop your spiritual intelligence as you're going through the 7 chapters of the book. There are also things called extended play resources, where I'll give you a link to a video by Deepak Chopra or Andrew Weil or somebody that's really going to help you operationalize this. And the leverage point is that as you develop spiritual intelligence, your EQ rises and your IQ rises. You get smarter because when you're in the state of peace and calm and love and compassion, then, for example, treating your body well, when you have compassion, when that insula of the brain is all lit up with spiritual intelligence, then what do you do to animals around you? You treat them with compassion. What do you do with your loved ones in your home? You act toward them with compassion. The Buddha said, in fact, Jesus said this so eloquently, that the old teaching is that you love those that love you and you hate those that hate you. And what I tell you to do, what Jesus said is, love your enemies, do good to them that hate you. And that's what the compassionate person does, is you feel compassion. And when somebody does something injurious to you or to others, you say to yourself, I see their humanity, even though their actions are unacceptable. And so this changes the way you are in the world. It changes the way you eat. It changes the way you treat your body. You love your body. You have self-compassion as well as compassion for others. So spiritual intelligence is this amazing leverage point over our diet, over our treatment of other people, treatment of the planet. You don't litter and destroy and exploit if you're living in that space of compassion. And that's why I'm such an advocate of spiritual intelligence, because as we do this, everything around us starts to change. And then in the final chapter of the book, I predict how it'll change the planet in the next 20 to 50 years, because we're seeing people becoming more compassionate in various ways, acting out of kindness. And I have a huge long list of ways in which society has been changing over the last 500 years. And there's, again, literally thousands of studies showing that people are becoming, on aggregate, more compassionate despite all the wars and turmoil in the world. So it really does affect every other domain of your life to develop that core of spiritual intelligence.
You just said it, and the analogy hit me like a ton of bricks. Mind, body, spirit, EQ, IQ, SQ, right? I mean, it's a beautiful analogy. Dawson, this is fantastic. Thank you for writing this book, because the world surely needs it. I don't know if we can wait 20 to 50 years, so I hope a lot of people start jumping onto this now, because there's a lot of angry, stressed, scared people on our planet. Dawson, as you know, I wrap up every episode by asking my guest, what is your biggest helping, that one most important piece of information you'd like somebody to walk away with after hearing our chat today?
If I were to give you one really simple take home, it would be to focus on your breath. This is not a new idea. Patanjali in the Yoga Sutras wrote about this 3,000 years ago. So when you're anxious, when you're overwhelmed, when you're stressed, simply tune back into your body, tune back into your heart, tune back into your breath, and just take a series of slow, conscious, mindful breaths. You'll find that starts to change. As your physiology shifts, it'll shift your mind, shift your consciousness, shift your awareness. And then you'll expand from that point on. You'll feel more centered. You'll feel anchored in your heart. You'll come back into your body. And all of those are leverage points for everything else you do. But in the middle of the stresses and the turmoil of the world, simply breathe, return to the breath, and make that your simplest of simple practices. I want you to do a whole bunch more things, like meditate every day as well. So I have a big agenda over here. And in fact, I want to recommend you meditate for 30 days nonstop. Download the free meditations in the book. They're all free. Download them and just use them for 30 days. We have hundreds of stories of people who've done this and seen their lives change completely. Only 20 minutes a day, but keep it up for 30 days and you'll see those brain changes going on. And it all starts with the breath. So meditate generally and specifically breathe.
Beautiful advice. The book is Spiritual Intelligence. We'll have a link to that in the show notes, of course. But if people want to learn more about you, Dawson, and all of the great things you're up to, where can they go on the internet to find that out?
Yeah, so get the book, spiritualintelligencebook.com, and then to download a free meditation that has to do with immunity, that's at my website, Dawson, my name, D-A-W-S-O-N, dawsongift.com. That also gives you access to our certified practitioners, to our classes, to all of the, you know, the free resources we have is at dawsongift, G-I-F-T, dawsongift.com. That's the best central place to find what we offer.
Amazing. And we'll have, again, links to everything Dawson Church, including spiritual intelligence, in the show notes at drrichardschuster.com. So we got you covered. Dawson, we waited 2 years for the follow-up. It was well worth it. Actually, we waited more than that. We waited 4 years to do this episode. really grateful we did. The work you were doing in 2021 was just as important as the work you're doing today. Thank you for coming on the show, and thank you for all that you do.
It's an absolute joy. And I'm going to say ditto, you are a world changer, Richard. Thank you.
Absolutely. I appreciate that. And I also appreciate each and every one of you who took time out of your day. If you liked it, if you're inspired, if you're going to go pick up spiritual intelligence and start your 30-day meditation practice, go give us a follow and a 5-star review on the podcast app of your choice, because this is what helps other people find the show. But most importantly, go out there today and do something nice for somebody else, even if you don't know who they are, and post in your social media feeds using the hashtag MyDailyHelping, because the happiest people are those that help others.